You're listening to Curiosity Invited with David Bryan here on LA Talk Radio.
Hello, my name is David Bryan, and this is Curiosity Invited, a podcast inspired by endless curiosity. Tune in for an open-minded conversation about interesting and important things. Well, welcome everybody. Welcome to Curiosity Invited. My name is David Bryan, and I have the great pleasure today of speaking with Roger McDaniel. That name may or may, depending upon where you are, that name may or may not be familiar to you. It was not familiar to me until about a month ago. I went to a panel or conversation with Roger McDaniel, that other fellow on the screen, and Alan and Pete Simpson. Alan Simpson, former senator, U.S. senator from Wyoming, and Pete Simpson, I think he was also in the legislature, yes, right?
But
he was a historian by trade.
Yeah.
And it was quite interesting and fun. And Roger has graciously agreed to come on the podcast. And Roger is many things, or has been many things, may be many things. But at that talk where I first came into contact with him, he is an author of several books. You can tell us how many. And the one that the most recent one, and the one he was speaking about and from, was this one, Profiles in Courage, the title of which might be familiar. Profiles in Courage was the title of JFK's, it wasn't an autobiography, it was a book he wrote way back when he was, I guess he was running for president or had just become president, and won the Pulitzer for it, I think.
He did. He wrote it in 1956.
Oh, so much before.
Ahead of 1960, but he had plans to become president.
Yes.
And this book was part of that.
Yeah. Well, it worked.
Yeah, it worked.
Yeah. So why that title? Well, it's the full title is Profiles in Courage, Standing Against the Wyoming Wind. So first of all, welcome, Roger, and thank you for doing this. I appreciate it. And if I get to call you Roger, right? I don't have to call you something else.
No, please do. Roger's good.
Okay.
Happy to be with you.
Yeah. So why that title? And why the book?
Well, a couple of things. The title does, as you said, come from John Kennedy's book, which I read when I was in junior high school and loved it. And over the years have reread it numerous times. And the last time I did, I said to myself, there really is a Wyoming book that could be written with that same title. And the Standing Against the Wyoming Wind is a reflection on the famous Wyoming winds that have blown strong across the Rocky Mountains for millennia.
Yeah.
You know, I note James Mishner's book, Centennial, how in that first chapter he has this marvelous geologic lesson. And part of it is the way in which the Rocky Mountains were formed by those incessant strong winds.
Mm-hmm.
And so I make the point at the outset of the book that it's the Wyoming political winds that have also formed our state.
Yeah. And
so the idea of the book was to identify people in the history of the state who have exhibited extraordinary courage standing against the Wyoming winds, which typically have blown strongest against racial and ethnic minorities and women. And so that's the genesis of the book.
Mm-hmm. And those winds, at least the point you make here, I think the winds tend to blow, well, still do. They don't just tend, right? They
right.
blow hard and powerfully and fast to the right, and this is a long-term phenomenon, which I wasn't aware of. You know, I mean, My before moving here, my contact with Wyoming was driving through and periodically and appreciating it, but not during the unexpected hailstorm when you get a flat tire and it's like, wait, it was just sunny. What happened?
Yeah, that's right.
And the winds were unbelievable, actually. Yeah. But what do you have a story for why are they blowing to the right? And why have they often been blowing to the right?
Well, that is an interesting story. And one of the things that I tried to accomplish in the book was to tell more than the stories of 13 people and groups of people who have exhibited courage. But if somebody reads the book, I wanted them to come away with an understanding of why we are where we are. And so the book ends with a discussion of Liz Cheney, mm-hmm. and the courage that she showed in taking the stand that she did against Donald Trump in the wake of the January 6th insurrection. But you can't understand how significant that was unless you understand the way in which the winds have blown since territorial days. Mm-hmm. And that history begins with the territorial legislature famously granting women the right to vote, for which Wyoming claims to be the equality state.
Yes.
But the part of the story that is told in the book that is most often overlooked is that a year after granting women the right to vote, they tried to repeal it.
Yeah, that was not a good idea. What was that? What were we thinking?
Exactly. And they passed it through both houses of the legislature, the repeal.
Yeah.
But the governor vetoed it, and his veto was upheld by one vote. And then a few years later, we get to 1890 and statehood and the Wyoming Constitutional Convention, which spent a great deal of time debating whether or not women should, whether this had been a good idea, and came close then to repealing the right to vote for women, and in fact imposed a literacy requirement aimed at the former slaves, who some of whom were coming into Wyoming, and the concern expressed by delegates to the convention was that they will ruin Wyoming like they've ruined the South.
Right.
And that we can't allow them to vote. And it was a literacy requirement that remained in the Constitution until the Voting Rights Act of 1965.
Yeah.
So the book tries to recount that in that entire political history so that people have a sense that what we're experiencing today isn't new. It's the trajectory.
Is it your sense, from what you know both about Wyoming and the rest of let's just stick with the United States, the rest of the country, maybe the rest of the world, I'm not sure, that there is a tendency that it is historically more conservative in Wyoming than elsewhere, not everywhere, but elsewhere, and do you have a clue about why that is? Like, why? What is it about? I mean, is it the terrain? Is it that? What? Why have the folks who have drifted here and settled here, and love it here, moved, leaned in that direction, where people elsewhere, you know, that's not been the case.
Well, I think that it is. Maybe the answer is found in analyzing what it was in the early days, you know, when people are moving west. Not very many people stopped in Wyoming.
Right, exactly. Why stop here?
But there's got to be a psychology about those who did. Those who stopped in the barren plains of Sweetwater County around Rock Springs, for example, who didn't go on to the Great Salt Lake Valley,
right,
and the fertile lands of Utah, but said, I'm going to make my home in this barren land that gets 6 inches of rain a year. And you know, you can't feed a cow on 10 acres of land. And there's some, in some sense, that wanting to be alone, mm-hmm. not wanting to be a part of the rest of the world, And that country allowed them to do that. And that really has been a part of the psychological makeup of the state ever since.
That's remarkable, really.
People don't like the outside. They don't want to be a part of what the rest of the country is doing.
Right.
You know, that whole idea of don't tell me how you did it back in Colorado.
Right.
You know, so
back in that liberal state of Colorado.
Yeah. So I think that's a large part of it, you know, and that translated in kind of ironically, a reliance on out-of-state corporations, a reliance on the federal government,
which pays
a good chunk of our budget, and yet this sense that we don't want to be a part of that.
Right. It is ironic, right? I mean, that's the piece. And by the way, let me just say at the front, I really enjoyed reading the book, and I've now had so many conversations and arguments with you in my mind about the book, about the title of the book, about, you know, is it courage? Is it discernment? Is it determination and not courage? I mean, it's really it's been a very rich and disturbing venture. So thank you. Really, thank you. There is a certain way in which that many of the solutions to the challenges of being in Wyoming, the geological challenges, the life challenges of being in Wyoming, are simple. And I don't mean easy, but they're simple, right? I mean, what do you do to stand against the physical wind, that brutal physical wind? Well, you need a sturdy structure, and we can argue about which is the sturdiest, and you need to face it in the right way. And that's it. And that's what you need, right? I mean, that's what you need to do. And I think, you know, so much of the world complicates some things, the solution to which are obvious, right there, right in front of you. And there's a certain, I've noticed here among the people that I met, there's a certain pride in, and I think a well-founded pride in seeing through the BS and the unnecessary complications of things and seeing the simple, straightforward solution. Not that it's easy to accomplish, but we know what's required. And you know, here's my bad psychology, or my bad speculation. Is there a tendency to then start to believe that, you know, all situations, all puzzles, all challenges have simple solutions if we would just follow them? And the sometimes sort of crazy making unwillingness to consider that, like, yes, but some things are complex,
mm-hmm.
right? I mean, some things, there is no easy answer. There is no straightforward answer. There are so many things to take into account. And now you go to a meeting of Republicans and there is a simple solution, no compromise, right? I mean, there's no, if compromise is for people who are not, you know, they are rhinos. They're not real Wyomingites. They're not real, right? Because we do things, we do the right thing and we do it. And it's, you know, I wonder if there's that, if there really is that somehow connection to that. And then another argument I have with you is like, so is there a solution? Is there a solution to all of this? And, you know, I kept wanting, I read your book and felt at the end very much like I would feel when I read Howard Zinn, my favorite, you know, like who writes with, you know, sort of incisive understanding and humor and at the same time you get to the end of it and it's well, that's what's required. This yeah. doesn't stop. There's never a goal. There's never, I take that back. There's never the end of the game. Because the game is democracy. And for democracy to happen, you know, you need to allow people to speak and to have their points of view. And you need to stand up to the wrong ones. And that's not going to go away unless you stop them from speaking. And then you wouldn't be having the democracy that you want. So at the end of it, it was, you know, like, well, this was great. And I'm exhausted.
Well, you know, part of the, I wrote a book once called Lois Matonin and Howard Zinn Fist Fight in the Equality State.
Yes.
It's a takeoff on Sherman Alexie's book, Tonto and the Lone Ranger Fist Fight in Heaven.
Yes.
But it was a Howard Zinn sort of look at Wyoming through the eyes of a woman whose grandparents were Finnish immigrants who came here in the late 1800s and worked in poverty for the Union Pacific Railroad, which is part of that interesting phenomenon of how many generations of people have been virtually impoverished while working full-time for large out-of-state corporations while rejecting labor unions. So there's that.
Yes.
One of the pieces of the personality in Wyoming and maybe other rural states is that unwillingness to grapple with the complexities of life.
Mm-hmm.
And we see it today in the issues about banning certain library books and penalizing transgender people and you know, the this unwillingness to grapple with the complexities of gender and just say, no, there's a man and a woman and that's it.
That's it.
Well, that's what it says in the Bible. God created man and woman. And so that sense that people really are more comfortable if things are clear, if they're black and white, and if they start to become gray, we just don't want to grapple with the science.
Well, and that I think fits right in with what you just raised, the numbers of things you have to ignore to think that it's so simple. Like, you have to ignore that, wait, this is, you're getting a big chunk of your budget from the feds, or you're, wait, this is a big corporation that you're working for. It's that, you know, that it became a meme during one of the Trump elections, you know, government needs to keep their hands off my Medicare and Social Security. Well, hold on, wait a second. Do you understand what you're saying here? Right. So is it a failure of education? Or is there forget the failure of education, but is there a solution in education? Is that where a solution lives? Or is there no solution? It's just the way it is.
One of the interesting responses, I think, to that question comes from Malcolm X, who was asked, you know, later in life when he becomes this sort of genius scholar intellect, and he's able to dissect the American political and social and economic situation in a way that few others on the left had been able to do, and somebody asked him, you know, he dropped out of school before he got a high school diploma. And somebody said, how is it that you end up being such an intellectual? And his response was, I was not poisoned by the American education system. And I think there's so much truth in that. The things that we did not learn in high school and even college have now come back to create this resurgence in racism and anti-Semitism. You know, if we had learned the truth about, for example, Jim Crow and about Reconstruction and so many other things, if we had learned the truth, we would be far better equipped in this generation to grapple with those issues honestly. We didn't learn the truth, and now when we hear it, it's like fingernails on a chalkboard.
Right. It's interesting. It's that, I forget who said it. Maybe it was Noam Chomsky. It was that, you know, American education destroying the mind one degree at a time. the pun being the degree. The higher you go in the educational system, right, the more you are cultivated for taking the role of leader. And I'm not sure I believe that fully, but I'm not sure I believe that it's is as broadly broadly successful as some people believe. But there is something to that.
But even today, you know, one can get a graduate degree from a significant university without being able to explain the impact of Reconstruction and Jim Crow on systemic racism. Which in my mind is one of the great issues of our time, that troubles politics and the economy and social relationships.
So when you finish the book, when you, you know, take a step back from your book and you finish the book, do you find hope in the instances of courage that these people displayed? And if so, what is that? What's the hope?
Well, you know, I'm a theologian.
Yes. We should say you're not only an author, you are a lawyer, a legislator, and you are a minister.
Right.
Yeah.
Yes.
For which church?
Presbyterian.
Yeah.
And so I'm in the business of hope.
Yeah.
And yet when I'm asked, where do you find hope? It's hard to identify that today. Mm-hmm. I mean, when you look at what is going on, you know, around the country now, the increase in anti-Semitism and hate crimes and the attacks on trans people and the LGBTQ community and the resurgence in racism and the Trump effect. And, you know, I look at the 2020 election. After 4 years, people saw what this guy was all about, and more people voted for him than they did the first time.
Yeah.
And so it's difficult to find, but we have to find it in the heroism of some people who are willing to, as I use the metaphor in the book, stand against the wind. And it's and that happens with such infrequency that they ought to have a book written about them, or at least a chapter of a book. They stand out.
When were you in the legislature, and what was the scene then?
I was in the legislature from 1971 to 1981, and that was sort of a lull in the extreme conservatism of the state that it was exhibited, you know, in the beginning and on into the days of the Klan and McCarthyism and the John Birch Society. And the 70s, you know, when you look at the 70s and a broad range of the Western and Midwestern states, there were iconic liberals, for example, in the Senate and in governor's office. You know, George McGovern and Gary Hart. Nebraska had, Montana had, renowned liberals. So there was that period of sort of a lull in the frontier states or the Western states that gradually was eroded by this sense that even the Republicans had become too moderate. And in Wyoming, the purity movement began in the 80s. When a group of Republicans decided they really needed to figure out how to purge their own party of these rhinos.
Right.
So I was in the legislature at a time when there was this sort of live and let live sense. So we didn't pass anti-abortion bills. We didn't discuss the LGBTQ issues at all. We passed landmark environmental legislation.
Were you a Republican or a Democrat?
Democrat.
You're a Democrat. And there were more of you, and people regularly collaborated, Republicans and Democrats, right?
Yeah, partisanship was, it existed, but not so that it interfered with passing helpful laws. In my last term in the House, we had an equal number of Democrats and Republicans in the Senate, and the Democrats were two votes short of a majority in the House.
Wow.
And while that was rare, it was never anything like today. Yeah. Today we have 101 legislators, and all but 9 of them are Republicans. And among the and these are the kinds of extremist conservative Republicans that the party has been aiming at electing for a long time. So it's altogether different environment.
Yeah. And they have the news slash, well, I don't want to call it news. The media situation has changed so dramatically that you really, and the inclination for people to self-silo, right? I'm going to listen to what I want to listen to, and what I want to listen to is what makes me nod my head and get riled up, and you know, but the Fox News situation is remarkable.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, you know, there's a ton of evidence that they're putting out stuff that they know to be false.
Yeah.
And yet, you know, okay, so Tucker Carlson, you know, doesn't do it over here. He does it over there. But you still have Sean Hannity and Graham. It's like Ingram. And, like, it's wild. It's really, it's a wacky world in that way.
It is.
And it helps to churn that situation where people don't have to even try to. Is there a rational kernel?
Yeah. Yeah, when I was in high school, I had a wonderful teacher named Nick Breitweiser, who in the 10th grade, Nick taught us from Eric Fromm's book, Escape from Freedom. And of course, that book was way over 10th graders' heads, but we grappled with it. And
I said, you must have gone to the genius school.
Wow. Well, and I can remember Nick had short hair, but I can remember him pulling it out as he listened to 10th graders try to define freedom and what it meant. And I've just often gone back to that concept is so difficult to understand and so easy to turn on its head.
Yes.
You know, freedom now becomes discriminating against trans people. Right. Banning books. We have a group called Moms for Liberty.
Yes, exactly.
That tries to ban books.
Their role is to ban books.
The Freedom Caucus, whose role is to deny freedom to anybody different from them.
Yep. Yeah.
So it's just a fascinating And for me, I trace it back to the death of the fairness doctrine. You know, Rush Limbaugh and Fox News could not have survived under the fairness doctrine.
Right. That's right.
But it went away.
It went away.
And I think, I was in my family and I lived in Nicaragua for a year in 1991. And when we came back, as we drove across the country, returning to Wyoming, every radio station through Alabama and Arkansas, Mississippi, and up to Kansas and Oklahoma and Colorado, every radio station had this guy named Rush Limbaugh on it. And it was bizarre. And I said to my wife after that trip, I said, if that's what most people in America are listening to, we're in trouble.
We're in trouble. Right.
We were.
And even, I mean, I was amazed because when he passed away, that was around the time I moved here, and there was a station, I'm not going to remember, well, I live in Powell, and there's a station that I was, you know, getting here, and I don't remember the name of it, but they, for the first year at least, they had a host, and they played Rush Limbaugh, old Rush Limbaugh, all these but goodies. I mean, that was... They just wouldn't let that guy go away.
Yeah.
It was really amazing.
Well, And you remember in the early days of that sort of talk radio, there was an effort to have talk radio on the left.
Yes.
And it would not succeed. It could not succeed, largely because they wouldn't say the sort of wild stuff that you hear from Limbaugh and G. Gordon Liddy, for God's sake, had a radio show.
Yeah.
And it never survived. And what survived is this stuff that people on Fox and Rush Limbaugh were willing to say.
Maybe like, for instance, with Limbaugh, maybe he, when he made a mistake, he spoke about it, but I don't remember any hearing or reading anything like that. I remember listening to him once when COVID was first starting, and it was, you know, COVID-19. Well, folks, you know, this is nothing to worry about. COVID is like a regular virus. And look at the name. I mean, 19. Why is it called COVID-19? Because there have been 18 versions before that. And it's like, no, it was because they found it in 2019. But like, that doesn't matter. That didn't matter. Nothing. None of it mattered. No. None of it mattered.
So, no. You say anything. And, you know, I think one of the most telling analysis that I heard about Nixon was that Nixon would have survived Watergate had he had Fox News.
Oh, yeah. Probably right.
That's the difference.
Yes.
People tend to remember that a group of Republicans went to him and said, you have to leave off. Well, those guys didn't go there until it was the tapes were released and
yes. The
public knew what was on the tapes. But the real difference was we didn't have that 24/7 news cycle from the right.
Yeah. Yeah. You speak about this in the book. It's, you know, the weighting has changed. Weight, W-E-I-G-H-T, right? It's like, I mean, you can't find a more vigorous supporter of Donald Trump and Donald Trump's policies from the moment he got the nomination until essentially the moment January 6th happened. January 6th, yeah. I mean, Liz Cheney was, you know, Trump's our guy. Whether it didn't matter what he did, didn't matter what he said, even when he said stuff about her dad. Yeah. Right? I mean, it was like, wow. And, well, maybe it's just my bias. It's like, what happened to those 4 years, Liz? Come on. Yeah. How many times did you have to stand up for him? And then finally he did something that was, and it's true, he did. But,
Well, and she did too. When you understand that in Wyoming, the Cheneys were royalty.
Royalty.
A beloved. I mean, Dick Cheney was, you know, and she was. In 2018, she wins an election 70-30.
Right.
And then after she takes the stand against Trump, she loses 70-30.
Right. Overnight. I mean, it's like
overnight.
Really? Overnight. Yeah. Right.
And she knew that would happen. And as I point out in the book, she knew that she wasn't only putting her political career at risk, but her life. Mm. I mean, the death threats that the genuine death threats were so ubiquitous that she wasn't allowed to campaign in a normal way. She could not say, I will be in Powell next Monday afternoon to meet with town hall meet. She could say afterward, I was in Powell.
I was there, yes.
But she couldn't tell people where she was going to be because the death threats were so serious. So she knew that would be the result. She had seen it happen previously. And, you know, one of the interesting things that I found in the research for the book that I hadn't realized just living through it was that the first time Donald Trump comes up with this, if I lost, it was because they cheated, was in Wyoming.
It was in Wyoming, yes.
When he lost the Republican convention vote in 2016 to Ted Cruz. And he said, oh, they're, you know, Wyoming, they're corrupt. They expect payoffs, and I wasn't willing to pay them off. And so I lost because they cheated.
There he is.
And Wyoming Republicans just
they love him.
Well, yeah. After he got the nomination, you know, Liz Cheney talked about Trump in 2020 the way she talked about Hillary in 2016.
Right. Exactly.
What a crook. And so yeah. But I you know, I voted for Liz.
So did I. so did I.
And I really was impressed with the courage it took. Not many other Republicans were able to do that, even in the face of January 6th.
Right.
You know, momentarily there were a couple, but their backbone quickly.
Well, I do want to believe it was about that. It was about integrity. There were certain things that mattered, and she would not overlook them. And so, and again, I just kept finding myself thinking, wait, I'm voting for Liz Cheney. This is the Liz Cheney that for so many years wanted to do things and did things that just were abhorrent to me. But yeah, I'm trying to get over that.
Well, that one act of standing up to him was, in my view, overrode all of that. We're really talking about the fate of democracy and the willingness of one person. Well, Adam Kinzinger is another, but Liz to stand out, and some of my Democratic Party friends would say, well, she's just doing that. She's calculated that that's the way she gets to run for president. Well, you know, nobody who opposed Trump is going to get near a nomination.
No.
In that party. That just, she was smart enough to know that.
Right.
But I thought it was courageous. And not only was she one of the first to criticize him on the January 6th thing, but then to accept Pelosi's invitation to be a part of the committee to investigate it, you know, that could have been something that if she was looking to save herself, that would have been taking a pass there. And she didn't.
Yeah. Well, you know, you're generous of spirit, and I sometimes need to be more of that. So are you always working on books?
You know, the first book I wrote was a biography of Lester Hunt, who was a Wyoming senator in the 50s who committed suicide in his Senate office after being savaged by Joe McCarthy and a couple of other Republican senators. Trying to force him out of the Senate. The Senate then was controlled by the Democrats by one vote. And Lester Hunt was a Democrat in Republican Wyoming.
Mm-hmm.
And when Senator Hunt's son was arrested for soliciting homosexual sex in Lafayette Park, these three Republican senators thought it was an opportunity to force his father out of the Senate and have him replaced with a Republican. A long story that was never told in Wyoming.
Really?
It was interesting. Senator Hunt's widow made it her life's cause to make sure that story was not told, because she didn't want her son dragged through that again.
Mm.
And both suicide and homosexuality were such taboos.
Mm-hmm.
She didn't want that story to become how her husband was remembered.
Mm-hmm.
Excuse me.
Yeah, no problem.
And I'd been in politics for many, many years and never heard that. I worked for Congressman Roncalio on his congressional staff. And the most he ever said about it was, you know, they treated Lester Hunt very badly. But the story of the suicide and his son was just never told. And so after I left my full-time job at the state of Wyoming, one day I got a friend request on Facebook from Lester Hunt Jr.
Really?
And we started talking, and I said to him, you know, somebody really needs to write your father's biography. And he said, well, why don't you do that? And I thought, well, I've never read a book, never wrote a book, never planned on doing that. And so he said, come on out to Chicago and let's talk about it. So I spent a week with him at his home. Remarkable man, very close confidant with Saul Alinsky. They worked together.
No kidding.
And in Saul Alinsky's autobiography, he credits Lester Hunt Jr. with being the key to his organizational work in Chicago. Very fascinating fellow. And he said to me, look, if you'll write the book, I'll be honest about whatever question you have. And so I did it.
Oh, that's something.
When I wrote that book, I never planned on writing books. I just wanted to tell that story. And one of the really remarkable things about it is that Buddy, they called him, Junior, Lester Hunt Jr. Buddy always, I said to him, how did you get through this, your father's suicide? And he said, years of psychological therapy.
Mm-hmm.
He assumed that he was the reason.
He was the cause. Right.
And had no idea that there had been this blackmail, this brutality for a year that they visited upon his father before he took his life. And after he read the book, he called me to say, thank you. Now I understand it wasn't me.
Mm.
And that was,
oh my God, that's
just a remarkable moment.
Yeah. Both for him and for you.
Oh,
what
yeah.
a wonderful gift to him. Yeah. My God.
Yeah.
And the research comes from, so are you a historian by training? I mean, where, you know, do you?
Oh. No, I joke, the head of the history department at the University of Wyoming referred to me once as a citizen historian.
was that a compliment or?
Well, I took that to mean that if I make a mistake, it's okay.
It's all right. But don't give up your day job.
That's right. That's right.
It's funny. That's really funny. Are you working on one now?
No, that you know, at the end of each one, I've said that's probably it. But an idea comes along that becomes compelling, and so, well, you know, I write for the last almost 13 years, I've written a weekly column for the Cheyenne newspaper, and so about 600 sermons over that. So wow. writing is really kind of what I do, and.
Yeah.
And enjoy doing that, and I write a column that is far left of center for Wyoming, and I figure that.
And how much hate mail do you get?
Well, my fair share. I'm disappointed when a column doesn't generate some response, but I got to recalibrate. But living in Wyoming is a little easier when you can tweak them now and then.
Yeah, yeah. And this, over the years, I mean, because it is such a interesting place, let's put it that way. Did you ever fear for your well-being or family's well-being because of the stances you took or the policies you tried to promote?
Well, I'll tell you a funny story in response to that. One night, about 11 o'clock, the doorbell rang and I opened the door and there were three policemen on my porch. And I said, what's going on? And one of them said, well, we have reason to believe that that somebody wants to do harm to you. And so we're patrolling the neighborhood and we wanted you to know why the patrol car was out front. And I said, well, what's going on? He said, well, there was a Facebook threat that somebody wanted to hurt you. And so I started looking around at it. And what I found was that there was a fellow in Casper, Wyoming, whose name was McDaniel, who talks about his membership in Antifa. And as a result, ends up in these bizarre Facebook arguments. And one night, somebody on Facebook said, if I knew where you lived, I'd come beat the hell out of you. And somebody said, well, he lives at and gave my address. And I turned to my wife, who always worries that someday at the supermarket, somebody's going to come up and punch me. I said, now, wouldn't that be the greatest irony that I would get beaten up by accident?
Right. Yeah, exactly. So, for all the things I didn't do.
Wasn't me. There was one threat that rose to the level that we involved law enforcement, but usually it's just quite a bit of the response I get is constructive, but some of it is pretty vitriolic and, and mean-spirited. But only one time in all those years has it risen to a point where we really were concerned.
And it occurs to me, courage is obviously important to you. Has it always been that way?
No, you know, I have to admit, in my early political days, I compromised on a lot of things that I wouldn't compromise on now.
But compromise because you quote lack the nerve, or because it was a way of getting something done.
Well, maybe both, but. You know, I recall early when I first ran for the legislature, I was 21 years old.
Oh, wow.
And I took a pro-life position on abortion. And then during a debate in the House of Representatives, one of my colleagues stood up and tearfully told a story about a situation he and his wife confronted when there was a late term medical diagnosis that the child would be born with certain deformities that would mean a short life filled with pain, and how they opted for abortion. And I remember the story today with chills, and said, I can never vote to stop somebody in that situation from making the decision. But I think it was a process that was heightened during the Trump years, seeing what was going on and how little courage was being exhibited, that caused me to think more and more about the role of political courage. And then, as I say in the book, There really has never been a time when it was more difficult for politicians to be courageous. And there's never been a time when it was more important that they actually are courageous.
And I think, you know, I think not enough credit is the willingness, and for politicians to do this publicly, but the willingness to see something you didn't see before and change your mind. I mean, you know, I notice it. We all notice it, probably. Certainly, those of us married, right? I notice it in arguments or conversations or disagreements with my wife, and you know that moment where you realize she's right.
Yeah.
And how, you know, how long the pause between that realization and saying, you know, you're right, and I'm sorry, and I didn't see it, and so. But there is I think for politicians, because they are so in the public eye and their positions are what matters, to be able to say, I made a mistake, is an amazing act of courage in some ways, because you really do risk your career, you risk whatever counts as, I guess, the embarrassment of, you know, as your hair gets this more and more our color, embarrassment is less and less relevant, but
it's punished in politics.
In politics, it is punished for sure.
You're a flip flopper, and nobody wants to be a flip flopper.
Right.
Politics. And the other thing is what we talked about with the concept of freedom. The concept of courage can be perverted. I mean, how many times have we heard the January 6th rioters described as courageous?
That's courageous. Yes, exactly. Right. Well, yeah, you'd have to take such a narrow, right?
Yeah.
It's like, is it courageous to do bad things to police officers when you think there's little chance of you getting caught? Probably not.
Yeah. But to do it in the name of what you think is right.
Yes.
You can justify that. And that was one of the things I wrestled with in the early days of thinking about this book is, how do you define courage? And in order to decide which stories I would tell, I had to figure out an operational definition for the term courage. And
what'd you end up with?
Well, for me, I went back to the ancient Hebrew prophets and the courage of people like Moses to get in the face of the Pharaoh, or Isaiah or Jeremiah or any of them, to confront these brutal, powerful kings about the way in which they were treating people. And then I talk about in the book, I think it is of such great significance that a group of 12 Wyoming historians studied the 20th century, tasked with deciding the top 10 news stories of the century. And three of the 10 dealt with the poor treatment of women in Wyoming history in the equality state, the poor treatment of ethnic and racial minorities, and the poor treatment of indigenous people. And so it seemed to me that if you look at Wyoming history in terms of identifying courageous moments, it had to have something to do with those who were either oppressed or discriminated against, or those who stood with them.
Right.
That was courage.
Right. That's interesting. Yeah. Yeah. There has to be a danger, which is one of those things. And I don't want to keep bashing Liz, but it's one of those things where it gave me pause. You know, there's a way in which many people that you speak about in the book, you know, very courageous acts. And I definitely understand the way in which Liz's actions were courageous. And, you know, without a life in politics, at the very least, Liz would walk from her office in Washington to a wonderful job at a major university or at least a think tank. So is there a loss? Well, sure. If you want to do this and you can't do this, yes, for sure. And the people that who used to be your allies, like Hageman, suddenly they're, you know, maybe that and it matters, but how much loss will you suffer from a certain perspective? Not very much at all. Right. Mm. I mean, and, you know, the Cheney name had already fallen from grace. A bit, at least. So,
yeah. Well, you know, that's a good observation on your part. All of the other stories in the book are of people who, to a great extent, exhibited courage throughout much of their life.
Mm-hmm.
Liz exhibited courage at one moment, a defining moment, I think.
Defining moment, I agree.
In American history.
Yes.
Yeah. And she did it in a way that was so inconsistent with what she had always been and what her father had always been, that it was ultimately so jarring to her Republican friends.
Mm-hmm.
I think, you know, people talk about whether she'll run for president and whatever she might do. I think she'll become largely irrelevant now.
Right. Right.
That one moment in time.
Right.
You know, had she not done that, she'd still be in Congress. She might have been speaker.
Yeah, absolutely. Exactly.
But that moment was defining.
Absolutely. Your relationship with The Simpsons.
Yeah.
So
complicated.
Tell me.
Interesting. You know, I always say, but for the voters, I'd have been a United States Senator. The truth is, but for Al Simpson and Dick Cheney, I might well have been. I ran in 1982 against a fellow named Malcolm Wallop, who was the incumbent. And As Al Simpson told the story to the audience in Cody, in Cody when we were on the book tour. In mid-October, just ahead of the election, the Reagan White House had a poll that showed me pulling ahead of Wallop, and said to Simpson and Cheney, "You got to do something," and they did, and it was ugly and swift and successful.
What did they do?
Well, a number of things. Alan talked about it at Cody. He signed a letter along with Cheney.
Oh, that's right.
That they sent to 20,000 Republicans who were identified as leaning toward voting for the Democrat. And it started out by saying, "Roger McDaniel is a snake in the grass. And he's a young lawyer who would say anything to get elected." And it was a four-page epistle, and a right-wing operative named Richard Viguerie was at the bottom of it. But in any event, this, and then they did this television commercial where Al said, "Oh, Dick, something evil has happened in this campaign, and this McDaniel, I don't want to serve with him in the Senate." And so it was really, really ugly. And as I said, it was successful. And for a long time, Alan made overtures to apologize. And eventually I decided, you know, there is a statute of limitations on this stuff. And and I'm in the forgiveness business. And so we reestablished our friendship, and he wrote the foreword for the first book I wrote about Lester. Huh. Now, you know, we had been friends before the 82 campaign, and became friends again.
That's an ugly game you were in.
Yeah, it was really ugly, but not near so ugly as it has become since.
Yeah.
And today, you know, I can't imagine running for office today. You know, the way the character assassination and the kind of money that is a part of politics. You know, in 1982, when I ran for the Senate, I raised almost $500,000, which was more money than any candidate in Wyoming had ever raised, except that year my opponent raised $1.2 million.
Wow.
And it really was the opening of the door in Wyoming politics for huge amounts of money and sophisticated media like we had never seen before. I think it was a watershed election.
Wow.
But it was such a different time. You know, and you look at the makeup of the Senate back then, and one of the offshoots of that campaign was a friendship I developed with Gary Hart, and then the way in which he got eaten up with that extramarital affair, which seems so tame today. I mean, today we've got a man who could get reelected president who was making hush payments to a porn star.
Right.
And the Republicans, the family values crowd, saying, what the heck?
Come on.
Yeah,
he's basically a good man, right? Really? Which parts am I missing? It is remarkable that, I mean, you know, this is banal at this point, but that there are that many people who supported and support this fellow who, I mean, you have to do enormous gymnastics to not end up thinking this is really not a good human being.
Yeah.
He's not, and so not well suited for this role. And yet the support of millions. Tens and tens of millions of people in the face of seemingly everything, anything. I mean, there was that moment when the idiotic thing he said in that first campaign, I could go outside in Times Square and shoot somebody and I wouldn't lose support. And wow, he might have been right.
Well, I think he was right. Yeah. And, but it, you know, how many times did he say something where most of us said, that's it, that's over? When he ridiculed John McCain.
How about that?
And the audience applauded.
Right.
It's like, what happened to that old reverence we had for veterans and POWs and people who had sacrificed?
POWs who said, no, I'm not leaving my men, and stayed.
Yeah.
What?
And all of that was just turned on its head in a flash.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I don't know what that says about America, but it's troubling.
It is definitely troubling. So maybe that's the next book that is more fully hopeful.
Yeah, there's a book there.
Yeah, somebody's got to write it.
Yeah, more likely Beschloss than McDaniel.
Yeah. Well, if I knew something, I know it's short, but if I knew something, what would I ask? What's something you would like tossed over the plate that you really want to talk about that I haven't just, we've steered it in some other direction?
Well, I think we've done pretty well. We've covered a lot.
Yeah. You sure you do. You're a lawyer. Remember the Skokie case?
Hell yes.
Right? Yeah. I mean, so, you know, I'm Jewish by birth. My Israeli friends remind me I'm Jewish, but, and the first time I read that case, it was like, wait, really? That is okay? And well, of course, it has to be okay. Because if you believe in free speech and democracy, it has to be for ideas you disagree with. It just has to be, right? I mean, like, you know, Hitler was it for free speech for ideas he agreed with? I mean, there's nothing to that. And so there's that, you know, we're confronted with this choice. How do we shut that down? Well, you don't shut that down. You speak against it. You come up with, you point out its mistakes. But boy, when there's nobody listening or no sense that the people who are listening can be persuaded by anything, then it feels like a war. You know, then you go from conversations about discourse and politics to battles, to, you know, it really is what's left after that. That's, you know, that I'm not sure that's a world I want to live in.
Well, but it may be the world that we're in. I mean, I often write about in my column, how do you have a civil conversation today? With the overpowering of like Fox News and worse. How do you have a civil conversation with people who believe that what happened on January 6th were like tourists strolling through the Capitol building? You say, well, maybe you can't have a civil conversation. Maybe you just win elections. Well, that's not working real well yet.
No.
I think that the next path is overpowering them, maybe politically, but how do you overpower folks who are willing to invade the Capitol building to stop votes from being counted?
Right.
How do you overpower people who turn the Electoral College into a playground for their own interests?
Mm-hmm.
These are challenging times and may redefine courage.
And I had this experience in Cody. I was walking and we were in the middle of COVID, sort of. I mean, if COVID existed in Wyoming, we were in the middle of COVID. And the signs were still up, and the people who worked in the grocery store and the supermarket had to wear masks. Most of them did. Some of them actually even wore them properly. But so you know, I'm walking into Albertsons, and I'm putting my mask on, and a fellow is walking out. Excuse me. And he walks up to me, and he wasn't hostile, but he was close. And he said, you know, you really shouldn't wear that. You're just living in fear. And in my mind and on the tip of my tongue was something that I chose not to say, which was, really, I'm living in fear. What are all these fucking guns about? Because he had one. Yeah. I didn't say it, but you know, there was a way in which, like, how do you have those conversations? Can you have those conversations?
And I think it's the question is so much different for Black and brown people and immigrants and refugees. Yes. And trans people, because the attempt there is to try to find a way to have a civil conversation with people who think you have no right to exist.
Exactly.
It's not an academic argument.
Right. Right. Exactly.
How do you get that? How do you tame that conversation?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, you should check out this this fellow, Daryl Davis. It's really quite amazing.
Yeah. So, yeah. Sounds like that.
Yeah.
Good.
Well, Roger McDaniel, I'm so pleased to have been able to speak with you. And I hope we got to places that were interesting for both of us. They certainly were for me. And and I hope you write a next book. And and I hope it's about where in these days do you find hope, given that you're in the business. So,
well, this has been fun. I've enjoyed this dialogue.
You're listening to Curiosity Invited with David Bryant here on LA Talk Radio.